Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to the author of The School Reform Landscape, Fraud, Myth, and Lies. I hope that you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be speaking with the author of The School Reform Landscape, Fraud, Myth, and Lies. The author is Chris Tykin. Chris, before we get started, did I mispronounce your name?
It's pronounced Tinkin, yes, Chris Tinkin.
Perfect. Chris, I know you just a little bit. We are both at Seton Hall University, but maybe you can just briefly introduce yourself and a little bit more about your background.
Sure, Heath. I've been an assistant professor at Seton Hall University in the Department of Education Leadership, Management, and Policy for 5 years. Prior coming to Seton Hall, I was a public school elementary school teacher, a middle school principal, an assistant superintendent, and I was also an adjunct professor at the Rutgers University Graduate School of Education.
Wonderful. But even before we get to the meat of the book, this is a collaboration that you have with your co-author, Donald Orlick. How did you come to write this book together? What's the genesis of the collaboration?
Well, as part of my work here at Seton Hall, I'm also the editor of two national education journals, the AASA Journal of Scholarship and Practice, which is the American Association of School Administrators research journal. It goes out to all the superintendents and central office people in the United States. About 16,000 folks get that, and it's also an open access journal, so it's read around the world. And I also edit the Kappa Delta Pi Record, which is their flagship journal for the Kappa Delta Pi Honor Society. We have a circulation quarterly of about 55,000 copies. And so Don was a person that I had solicited to write an article about common standards, standardized curriculum. And through that collaboration, we found that we were kindred spirits, and we decided maybe we need to expand this topic and write an entire book.
And I think what you're suggesting is maybe the audience for this podcast is now quadrupled. There's the potential now that many, many more people outside of the field of political science will be listening to this. So that's very exciting, and it's wonderful to sort of see this kind of research that is speaking both to the academy but also has an audience and applicability outside of the university setting. So, and you know, with that said, the book is great. It really is a really enjoyable read. It's as we talked about a little bit before, it's provocative in many ways, and you take on some real important, as you put in your title, some important myths. One of the myths that you address very early on in the book, in which I wanted to get the conversation started, which is about Sputnik. And maybe even before we get to the meat of the book, let's talk about one of the references you make in Chapter 2, which is to a 1995 song by Bon Jovi and Sambora. I don't know if Bon Jovi and Sambora have been cited in an academic book before. How are they incorporated into this argument you're making about Sputnik?
Sure. Bon Jovi and Sambora have a song off their album These Days, and the song is called These Days. And in that song, they use a phrase called the vagabond king with a styrofoam crown. And I heard that phrase, and it struck me that, yes, that really sums up Sputnik in one phrase, because Sputnik is really the genesis of the school bashing and the current school reform movement. Everybody refers to it as if Sputnik was somehow a meaningful event in terms of school reform.
And let's talk a little bit more about Sputnik, because Sputnik is something that comes up a lot, and people refer to the Sputnik moment as many things, and it's used to serve many purposes. Your argument here is that it's been misused and misunderstood and misrepresented. To what end? This is really sort of the historical starting point that you begin with, though you tell some of the sort of history of school reform before this. But this movement to describe a educational problem that exists in the country. In many ways, starts at this point. So what does the myth misrepresent about the nature of education in the U.S., and to what end? What has this done for school reform advocates?
Well, most recently, we've heard President Obama refer to the Sputnik moment in a State of the Union address, and then also his Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, has referred to the Sputnik moment several times. Now, every time they do that, they're not doing it to describe public education in a positive way. They're using it to describe a crisis that exists, and they're using it as an analogy to a perceived former crisis back in the 50s. So the way that Sputnik is used today to drive school reform is really to create fear and crisis, because I guess some people like the president or Arne Duncan simply don't have access to the public records that exist that state otherwise.
And part of that public record is some of the research that you did, and you had access to some, I don't know, were they declassified or documents, but related to the way, in part, the Eisenhower administration was trying to position this issue and how they tried to link it to school reform. What was the method that you used in sort of investigating this?
Correct. We went into the Library of Congress and then also the Eisenhower Library, and we looked for all of the declassified, these used to be top secret memos about the Sputnik meetings that Eisenhower had with his cabinet. They've now since become declassified, you know, because they're older than 50 years. And we were able to find them in the Library of Congress and the Eisenhower Library. They are now public information, and we began to read the minutes of the meetings that Eisenhower had with his cabinet following the launch of Sputnik. And we chronicle that in chapter 2 of the book in terms of how Eisenhower, in the memos, says he was not concerned at all with the quality of public education. He didn't see Sputnik as a crisis in public education at all. In fact, he saw it as a great opportunity to avoid World War III over space. And in chapter 2, we quote that he said the Soviets actually did us a good turn by opening up space.
We'll come back to the sort of the Soviet analogy in a little bit, because it's one that you bring into our current time period. But before we get to that, I also want to talk about something else that you address in chapter 2, which is the role that foundations have played in school reform. I had the chance to talk to Sarah Reckow a couple of weeks ago about her book on foundations and the current school reform period. But they've been around for a while, and one of the things that you say in quite a provocative way, and just to quote from chapter 2, you write, "The effectiveness of conservative institutions also comes from the fact that they deliberately focus on shaping public policy, making them overtly political bodies." I wonder if you're referring there to the Kellogg's and Ford's and Gates's in this case, as was the focus of Sarah Reckow's book, or are you referring to a different set of foundations? How have foundations played a part in school reform?
We are, in fact, referring to those foundations that you listed, plus foundations like the Walton Foundations, the Walton Foundation, which supports heavily with millions of dollars a year, the charter school creation. Remember, the Waltons own Walmart. So we look at those conservative foundations that are really spearheading and funding some of these latest school reform efforts. And they've become major players in the policymaking arena, because what they do is they consistently put out professional-looking reports that are empirically bankrupt. But as you know, sometimes policymakers don't have a lot of time to really look into the methods and look into the data, and they just read the conclusions. And I think that's a lot of what's happening today. And there seems to be a preponderance of these foundation reports that come out constantly and nonstop. Now, you know, and on the other side, there's progressive foundations as well that put out reports to drive their agenda. But as we say in the beginning of the book, you know, one of the lenses we use to look at these reform movements is the lens of liberty and justice for all. So we're not against school reform as long as it forwards the idea, it makes real for all kids, the idea of liberty and justice for all. And so when we look at, you know, foundations in general, it seems that this group of conservative foundations isn't really interested in liberty and justice for all. They're interested in liberty and justice for a few.
Mm-hmm. And one of the specific reports that you refer to in the book is the one that most people know about, which is A Nation at Risk. And this was the report that was written in the mid-1980s. And, you know, other than Sputnik is that other kind of major totem that people refer to in education policy as the, you know, the indicator that, that things weren't all right. But you refer to A Nation at Risk as an intellectually vapid and data-challenged piece of propaganda. This is a big statement to make. What do you mean by that? What do you mean that A Nation at Risk was intellectually vapid and data-challenged?
Well, we mean just that. When you read A Nation at Risk, we challenge anyone to go ahead and find the actual data that that support the claims and conclusions that they draw. Because we've tried to do it. David Berliner tried to do it. The authors of the rebuttal to A Nation at Risk, the Sandia Report, tried to do it. And you just can't find the data that support their conclusions. It's problematic. And so then when you look at the definition of propaganda, and you look at the substance of A Nation at Risk, and you look at how it's since been used, those two things match up pretty closely.
Yeah, but most people haven't viewed it in that way, and in fact, most people have viewed it as a statement of deep truth. And as a result, we've had, you know, like, I guess at this point, 3 decades of school reform that have been driven in part by the assumptions and arguments made in A Nation at Risk. What's been wrong with approaching school reform with a foundation built on a document and an argument made in A Nation at Risk? Are there reforms that have been pushed perhaps wrongly because of that, and other reforms maybe that have been pushed to the side because of the assumptions of A Nation at Risk?
Well, I think one of the biggest dangers of approaching reform from a basis that contains no evidence is that we're talking about kids here. Children are compelled to attend school. Most of the children in this country attend public school. 49.8 million or so attend public school. They're compelled to do so, but yet they have no voice at the policymaking table. So we rely on the adults, the policymakers, the school administrators, so on and so forth, to make policies that would be in their best interest. So now we run into this problem where policies are being made based on a set of conclusions from a report that contains no evidence. I sometimes draw this analogy. It's like, you know, would you give your kids medicine that hasn't been validated by the FDA?
Yeah,
I probably wouldn't do that. But yet, what we're doing now is we're providing school reform interventions that are built really on a series of, like I say, frauds, myths, and lies. And we don't really know the contraindications, the negative consequences that could happen.
Now let's talk about some of the specific reforms that you take on and try to unpack in certain ways, which you at one point summarize them as Stalinist inspired. So what goes into this bundle of reforms? You talk about a couple of them, the ones that are probably familiar at this point to many people, but what are the part of the current what's part of the current landscape of education reform?
Sure. When we look out at the landscape, the biggest thing that we see is the standardization and centralization of decision making and implementation. Now remember, our country is built, it's founded on local control. From the colonial times, we were under a local control form of government. Even though we were under British rule, the colonists set up their own local governments. And that's part of our culture. And our education system, of course, because education mirrors society, was a local control system. But for the past, I would say, since the Reagan administration, so we're looking at about 33 years, there's been a slow erosion of local control. The most recent would be that everybody would be familiar with would be the No Child Left Behind Act, where the federal government, vis-a-vis voluntary participation by the states, began to direct the curriculum and assessment practices at the local level. And now we've taken it one step further, bipartisanship under Obama and the Republicans in terms of the Common Core state standards and the new national testing initiative. So for really the first time in this country's history, curriculum is being determined by a small group of elites far away from your and my kids' schools. That's problematic culturally, but it's also problematic educationally, because actually there's a good deal of research that shows that when curriculum is developed and customized at the local level, kids do better. So I'm real concerned from a cultural perspective and just from an evidence-based perspective that this idea of centralization and standardization is pushing us in the wrong direction.
Now, what do you attribute this to? You'd be hard-pressed to find another major policy area, particularly one that has such high levels of salience, where there was such agreement and uniformity across jurisdictions, across political parties. It's very hard to distinguish between the Obama administration's education policy and the Bush administration. And it's hard to distinguish between the Bush administration and the Clinton administration in major ways. Of course, there are some small differences. So to what do you attribute this homogeneity in thinking about school reform, given in other areas there's such disagreement and difficulty reaching consensus? In education, it seems to be quite natural.
Heath, when I step back and I zoom out on this topic, I think what you're really seeing is the corporatization and privatization, marketization of education. So when we step back even further, I'm going to use a term that all of our listeners might not be familiar with, but it's the influence of the neoliberal ideology on education. And basically, in layman's terms, it's the belief that the market, competition and a free market, will raise quality, increase efficiency, and all things will be good. But the history of neoliberalism in the public sphere is not a good one, and we don't believe that it belongs in public education. But I think that's the driving force, the neoliberal ideology, the market ideology, that's really driving all these reforms now. And that's why it cuts across party lines, because both Democrats and Republicans have embraced markets and competition in one way or another to varying degrees. But they've both embraced this idea in terms of improving public services when the evidence suggests otherwise.
And so, given that, and I would agree with that, when we actually, I'll be talking with Daniel Stedman Jones, who has this very interesting book that just came out called Masters of the Universe about Hayek and Friedman and the development of the neoliberal agenda in many ways. And so, this idea is around in the conversation, but there are other voices out there, and you're very in touch with the school administration world. Where are the other voices out there for alternative approaches that depart from the neoliberal philosophy, that approach school reform in a decidedly different way?
Well, I, you see some of the voices, like I said, in the more progressive think tanks and the more progressive foundations. But even in the education world, and we take this on in Chapter 9, many of our own leaders, both school administrators and especially our leaders of our national organizations, have really drank the Kool-Aid on this one. They seem to believe all the myths, frauds, and lies, and they perpetuate them, through their different conferences, through their administrative preparation programs, so on and so forth. So, there are other voices out there, but I think they're not very organized. So they get drowned out by this highly organized neoliberal network.
So, are you, it sounds like you're pretty pessimistic about school reform. How do you approach this with your students? Talking about the power and influence of the neoliberal philosophy on education reform, are you an optimist on any level about what's to come, the next iteration of No Child Left Behind, or the next reauthorization of of the major parts of the education policy portfolio?
I don't think I'm a pessimist. I think maybe in the foreign policy world, they might categorize me as a realist, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the way I think about it. You know, it took us 50 years to get to this place, okay? It might take us another 50 to get out of here, because I don't think much is going to change until the larger population sees all the flaws of these current policies. And that just takes time, because the things that we're talking about today aren't really the things that are talked about at PTO meetings or PTA meetings. And until they are, I don't see much change, because that's who's going to change this, are the taxpayers, the parents who are sending their kids to these schools that are really becoming just watered down employment training institutions. So I think we will overcome this, but I don't think it's going to happen in an election cycle or two.
So what's up next for you? Do you have a continuation of this project? Is there a new book that's on the horizon? What's your next research project?
Sure. Yeah, I've already been in development with the next book. Clearly, from reading this book, you can tell that one of my main concerns is the standardization and centralization of schooling, curriculum, and assessment. So I think down the road here, in the not too distant future, there'll be a book that incorporates the neoliberal influence on standardization and centralization. So that will undoubtedly focus on the Common Core, the national testing, Race to the Top, the NCLB reauthorization, and we'll kind of take those things apart using a little bit of a different lens, and then offer probably an even more robust set of proposals to overcome this. Because I think really the time is right for some of us to be putting out some pretty specific proposals on where we can go.
Chris is the author of The School Reform Landscape, Fraud, Myth, and Lies. The book was published this year by Roman Littlefield, available at their website. I'm sure that it's also available on Amazon. I've read the book and enjoyed it a lot. I hope that you read it too. Chris, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath. Enjoyed it. Thank you.